D.C. And on behalf of the C.S. Lewis Committee, I want to welcome you all to this year's lecture. For those of you who like to plan ahead, are you ready? Get out your calendars. April 8th, 2002 will be our next lecture in this series. And next year's lecture will be given by Dr. David Lyle Jeffrey, a professor emeritus from the University of Ottawa and currently distinguished professor of literature and humanities at Baylor University, a noted scholar in medieval studies in the Bible and literature. So I know you're going to want to put that on your calendar looking ahead for next year. The one thing all of us, I think, are sensitive to is the way that generations frequently found strength for their journey by turning to the writings of C.S. Lewis. Speaking across time and cultural divide, classics like Mere Christianity and the Screwtape Letters, two of the most familiar, have guided many towards home, towards a center where the life of faith provides an axis of meaning for life. Throughout his career, Harold Dean Trulier has also been drawn to those for whom life may seem an exile. Even as professor and pastor, he has looked to the city and, like Lewis, provided a way towards a life of faith for those thousands of high-risk youth and young adults who otherwise might also have slipped through the cracks. At a conference at Yale this past weekend, a friend brought out a book he was reading on the multiple religious cultures of New York City. It was no surprise as I leafed through the table of contents to find that Harold Dean Trulier had written one of those chapters. Epitomizing the best in what we have recently come to call faith-based institutions, the public-private ventures with which Dr. Trulier is now working, with several organizations committed to those in the inner city, they are committed to renewal of not simply the inner city, but to renewal of the inner life, to making the city not an exile, but a home. And we are honored this evening to have with us Dr. Harold Dean Trulier, who will speak to us on longing for home, C.S. Lewis and the Exile. Will you join me in welcoming Dr. Harold Dean Trulier?
It is a privilege to be here in Chattanooga this evening. Thank Dr. Lippe for that marvelous introduction. I hope I can get a copy of it. It's the second best introduction I've ever been given. The best one I ever had was about 10 years ago when my daughter was in preschool, and I walked in to pick her up, and she looked up, she nudged her friend and said, "That's my daddy." And that's the best introduction I've ever had. We'll put the watch there. Not that that means anything. I was pastor of a Baptist church once, and I took my watch off and looked at it, and I guess the deacons were wise to me. One of them yelled out, "That's all right, there's a calendar behind you." But I do want to make sure that we're all out in time for one of the most significant religious events in the American civil religious consciousness, Duke versus Arizona. When I was first asked by the committee to make this presentation, I found myself saying, why? I'm not a C.S. Lewis scholar. Sure, I've read Lewis, and I've sat up with my kids pouring through Screwtape Letters, trying to figure things out with them. But the committee was insistent. They said, "We think that there's something that you two have in common." And so I began reading not just Lewis's writings again, but reading Lewis's own journey, his autobiographical work, Surprised by Joy, his own sense of his journey. And I found myself intrigued by his sense of his own marginality. And so I've given title to this presentation, I'm Building Me a Home, which is from an old Negro spiritual where the words are, I'm building me a home, I'm building me a home. This earthly house will soon decay and my soul's got to have somewhere to stay. For indeed, as we look at Lewis's career and we look at the career of other persons so marginalized as Lewis was, we find that this desire for home, this desire for a place, this desire for some form of center becomes a driving force. So to present a lecture in the spirit of C.S. Lewis is to offer reflection on the struggle with marginality, with faith, and with voice. Faith, because Lewis's own faith legacy continues to influence many contemporary thinkers. Not the least of these is Yale University constitutional law professor Stephen Carter, whose recent critical analysis of religion and politics has the title God's Name in Vain. It drew much of its inspiration from Lewis's essay, Meditation on the Third Commandment, to which we shall return in a bit. What makes Lewis' faith all the more critical to my own understanding of Christian faith is that he is a layman, pressing hard, as other laypersons like William Stringfellow, Jacques Ellul, Verna Dozier, and the above-mentioned Carter, pressing hard into the public square as passionate voices that both argue for and model the need for the religious presence in public life. It's easy for preachers to do. We get paid to do it. It's harder for lay people to do because there's no money in it. It's not just the faith of a layman, it's also the voice of a layman. A voice is more than words. A voice has meaning only in the context of conversation. Speaking and listening are both required for voice. And Lewis spoke and people listen. Lewis speaks and people listen. And so the spirit, the voice of Lewis has power because it is heard. Not just because it is profound, but because it is heard. It finds a resting place amidst the cacophony of competing calls in the marketplace of ideas on the public square. Carter has picked it up at Yale. He picks it up by pointing to Lewis' recognition of the danger of trying to form a Christian party in the 1940s and drawing parallels between that misgiving and Carter's own worries about contemporary attempts to take the Christian faith and identify it with one political party or the other. Carter worries about evangelical and fundamentalist churches equating their agendas with the Republican Party, and similarly worries about African-American congregations and church leaders identifying their agenda with the Democrats. C.S. Lewis, says Carter, would not be pleased. Carter himself will be heard next week as the Devane Lecturer on Religion and Democracy during Yale's tercentenary founding. And as such, he will be bringing Lewis' legacy squarely into focus in the contemporary political climate, where the reconfiguration of the relationship between government and faith-based organizations has sparked incredible debate and confusion. If there is any good about this debate and confusion, I think it is summed up by the columnist E.J. Dionne, who in his recent column reminded us that at least while the left and the right are shooting at the National Faith-Based Initiative, they are talking about it. 10 years ago, when Stephen Carter wrote his first major work, The Culture of Disbelief, nobody was talking about religion in the public square. The fact of the matter is, now everybody's talking about it. In fact, Carter believes many people are talking about it wrongly, hence the title of the book, God's Name in Vain. Dionne says we ought to at least be glad for the conversation. Folks are talking about religion again. I think C.S. Lewis would be pleased. But that's his voice, and that's his faith. I find myself, as I mentioned earlier, most fascinated by his struggle with marginality. Now, this may seem at first to be a trite observation. I mean, how do you talk about being marginal when you teach at Oxford? There are many more marginal places to stand than at Cambridge. Yet the margin looms as text for one who writes apologetics as a layman. science fiction as a professor of classical literature and children's books while being a scholar. The margin is office space for one who does not receive proper promotion to professorship in spite of or because of his body of work. And the margin is home for one who is rankled that he obtained greater visibility and notoriety for screw-taped letters than for his serious scholarship. Yes, for Lewis, the margin is home. He wrestles with it. He struggles with it. He knows he's there, but he doesn't like it. And neither do I. Neither do most people I know on the margin. And my fascination with C.S. Lewis is that his marginality combines with the yearning for recognition by the very center that pushes him off to the side. And this brings me face to face with the wrestling and the struggling of middle-class African Americans who similarly live on the margin but yearn for that sense of center, that place of recognition. And so we wrestle in the middle class in the black community with the whole question of marginality, not so much from the perspective of an alienated underclass or the isolated poor, we know better, but rather as the legatees of a testament of identity crisis that has plagued blacks in this country as we, as a race, struggle to find a home in this country. I define blackness in the United States as a political reality. I join Manning Marable, the African-American political scientist and cultural critic, in this designation. Marable, in looking at African-American race and the whole question of home, argues forcefully for understanding blackness as a political construct, not an ethnic one. It is a political construct, says Marable, because black is a racial designation, and race is always about political arrangements and social conventions. It's about where folks belong. Where do you put them? It determines place, space, and home by virtue of physicality, by what you look like. He contrasts this with ethnicity, a cultural designation that refers to the values, mores, folkways, and beliefs of a group. Blackness is not ethnicity. Racial profiling on the New Jersey Turnpike does not require any knowledge of culture or ethnicity if you're guilty of DWB. And you may not know what it's driving while black. So something we have to wrestle with on the New Jersey Turnpike from time to time. In fact, when my 17-year-old got his driver's license, included in the instructions were when they pull you over, you put your hands here because I don't want my son to be a statistic or a victim of some kind of confrontation with police. So many of us in the African-American community, we teach our children when they're learning to drive, part of how you respond when you're pulled over. Keep your hands visible. Don't get out the car. I like to keep my hands here when I'm pulled over, and that's where I tell my kids to put their hands. But nobody asks me about my culture. They don't ask me whether I like the Baja Men or Roland Hayes. Culture is not a part of the conversation. It's physicality. It's race. Blackness is therefore political. The racial profiling policemen do not look for Jamaicans, Angolans, Nigerians, Haitians, Cape Verdeans, Atlantans, Harlemites, Bill Clinton notwithstanding, or OGs from the West Side. They don't look for my dogs who are down with me from the East Side. They look for black. They don't look for country. They look for race. They don't look for ethnicity. They look for color, not for culture. Much of the struggle of the African American, especially in the middle class, in those seemingly non-marginalized places like the Harvards and the Yales, where I teach, are struggles that have to do with will we ever fit at home, even in the midst of comfort? Where do you put them? Where do they go? Where do they fit? What are their life chances, opportunities, neighborhoods, job openings? Black middle-class people, black middle-class Christians indeed, to whom I ultimately will address some remarks this evening, are never fully integrated, always visible, always calling up for some non-black certain images. Hold your pocketbook. Must be an affirmative action appointment. Are you here on an athletic scholarship? What do you play? And black reflection on those images and their implication for place and a sense of home have been part of African-American culture and history since their inception. This struggle is not confined to the poor. It is possible to be part of the middle-class mainstream and still be marginalized. This struggle is not confined to the ghettos of isolation, whether urban, rural, or first-ring suburban. Indeed, the struggle for home may be even more complex for middle-class African-Americans who have made it, like Lewis did, on the one hand, but receive ongoing signals that they really don't belong on the other. Some of you may have read journalist Ellis Coase's book, The Rage of a Privileged Class. He documents there such complexity. Coase interviewed scores of middle-class blacks to record their experiences of discrimination. Again, not so much that these experiences were as bad as chattel slavery or segregation in public accommodations or physical intimidation, but rather that these experiences, at minimum, reminded these people that middle America was not home. He talks about not being able to get a cab in New York City. He talks about the executive, the partner in a law firm, who was accosted by one of the junior members of the firm when he came in on a Saturday wearing a jogging suit. Obviously, a black man in the jogging suit on Saturday is here to steal something. It's why I never wear a blue suit when I ride Amtrak, because people always ask what time the train's going to get in. You know, I'm on Amtrak. No blue suits today. You know, I'm not, you know, because then I'm going to say something smart, you know. I don't know, what's your schedule? And then somebody at Amtrak's going to get a complaint, and the guy that really is working on the car is going to get fired. But these signals that come to you always let you know that you don't belong. In this case, they're based on physicality. It means always knowing you're black despite the well-meaning messages delivered to you by college. I don't see you as black. I see you as a person. That's my favorite one. Which means that you don't see the experiences that remind me that I'm an outsider. W.B. Du Bois put it this way in 1903 in The Souls of Black Folk. One ever feels his two-ness, one African, one American, two souls striving in one dark body, held together by sheer dogged determination. One comic puts it this way. He says, a black man kneels to pray, Lord, why is my skin so dark? God says, it is to protect you from the heat of the African sun, my child. Lord, then, why is my hair so knotty? And God says, it is to protect you from the humidity of the African tropics, my son. Lord, why is my nose so broad? And God says, it is so that you will be able to breathe the hot air in the African climate, my son. Lord, why are my limbs so long? It's so you can run swiftly through the African forest. Well, then, Lord, I just have one more question. How come I live in Harlem? Indeed, why do I live in Harlem? Why do I live in Chattanooga? The punchline to this dialogue receives its power from the historic African-American struggle to identify home. Kidnapped from tribes and continent, Africans were brought into bondage in the Western Hemisphere over a period of centuries. The brutality of chattel slavery has been well documented. Indeed, human social and political bondage in and of itself carries its own message of degradation of an assault upon the human spirit and its attendant image of God. But there is an oft-overlooked dimension of American slavery whose legacy demands our attention. In this age where structures for identity creation have been shaken, relativized, and even destroyed. And that is that slavery, while a physical displacement for a people, was also a physical displacement from the sense of home for people whose notions of identity was tied to land. You take me from the land, I'm not home anymore. Sort of like the Hebrews who said in the 139th Psalm, how can we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? Home is the place of belonging. Home is the place of identity creation. Home is the guarantor of security. Home is the context of the development of personhood and worth. Home is not where the heart is, it's where the hearts are. Communities of human sustenance that and recognition that create the safe space for self-discovery and value. Home is the place where liberty and responsibility meet and mate to become the parents of human freedom. In West Africa, as in many parts of the world, home was tied to place, land, and locale. When home was taken from the Africans in their brutal journey westward, and subsequent slave enslavement, they lost that place for identity creation. This sense of dislocation and the resulting identity crisis of enslaved Africans serves as the backdrop for much of the oral culture of slaves that persists into current consciousness. Search the spirituals and the recurring theme of home, needing a home, displacement from home, longing for home appears time and time again. Sometimes I feel like a motherless child, a long way from home. Swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home. I got a home up into that kingdom, ain't it that good news? Trampling, trampling, trying to make heaven my home. Steal away to Jesus, steal away home. I ain't got long to stay here. I've heard of a city called heaven. I'm trying to make it my home. I'm building me a home. I'm building me a home. This earthly house is going to soon decay, and my soul's got to have somewhere to stay. Indeed, Lawrence Jones, the Dean of African American Church Historians, gave title to his seminal essay on the historiography of African American Christianity, They Sought a City. Jones understood that the city metaphor, though drawn from biblical imagery, had much more to do with the need to locate the space that is home, the place of freedom and identity creation. Enslaved African American Christians sought home and did so in a number of ways. Often home was heaven, the place where God reigns supreme. The text of the Negro spirituals mentioned earlier all point clearly to heaven as home, that place unfettered by racial bias, unmarred by racial injustice, unblemished by racial bigotry. Heaven stood as real space in real time and provided enslaved believers with a context for reflecting on their God-given humanity. One of the spirituals, I Got Shoes, pointed to this sense of home. I got shoes, you got shoes, all God's children got shoes. When I get to heaven, going to put on my shoes and shout all over God's heaven. Well, what does this have to do with home? Well, the people who sang that they had shoes were barefoot, and they understood that shoes were a sign of status in the culture in which they lived. The only people who wore shoes lived in the house. I Got Shoes was the affirmation that they had status. Shoes were symbols of status long before Nike and Adidas came along. I got shoes, I got status, all God's children got status. That status, however, is reserved for me in heaven, but I speak of it in the first tense because I'm already drawing down on the status that is part of my identity creation. And if that's not enough, the next line of the spiritual critiques those who believe that they've already found a home. Everybody talking about heaven ain't going there. Heaven was not the only place, however, to which African-American Christians looked as home. For some, Africa held sway as home, as reflected in the adoption of African as an ethnic and racial designation by blacks, and the creation of such institutions as the African Methodist Episcopal Church in 1816, the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church in 1796, the Free African Society of Philadelphia in 1787, and the African Meeting House of Boston. If Africa wasn't home, then why would they have used the term African? African Americans, both enslaved and free, were part of missionary movements to Africa, motivated by a sense of home. Very often, they quoted from the 68th Psalm, princes shall come out of Egypt, and Ethiopia will stretch forth her hands unto God. The early missionaries to Sierra Leone were former enslaved African Americans who fought for the crown for King George during the Revolutionary War, and upon losing the war, migrated to Nova Scotia, and then under the leadership of William Wilberforce, went to Sierra Leone as missionaries because of their sense of home. Even the folklore of enslaved African Americans contains tales of blacks who would, in an apocalyptic moment, sprout wings and fly back to Africa. The more common alternative to heaven as home, however, actually builds on heavenly imagery as opposed to African. Here the slave narratives often point to the double meaning of spiritual texts, the idea that the heaven of the song text also referred to the freedom of the North. So that home was a place of freedom, as we mentioned earlier. To be heaven-bound was to be on the road to freedom, freedom in the northern states, or even freedom in Canada. This journey came to be juxtaposed with the Exodus narrative of the Hebrew Scriptures so that the image of the promised land in heaven, as well as the freedom that belonged to them in the north, all became the desired destination of home. No less than Frederick Douglass, the abolitionist and ex-slave, offered in his autobiography that when enslaved persons on his plantation sang of Canaan, they actually sang of Canada, an eschatological play on words. The Exodus then emerged as the principal narrative event through which enslaved Christians interpreted their experience. Perhaps the best known of the Negro spirituals to articulate this idea was Go Down Moses. This retelling of the Exodus narrative became a forceful interpretive scheme for the faith community. The story embodies the activity of God on behalf of his people, the heroism of Moses standing and speaking for God, and the reality of oppression under Pharaoh. They were longing for freedom and longing for home. The Exodus motif endured in African-American Christian thought well into the 20th century and even into the 21st. Black leaders from Harriet Tubman to Martin Luther King have the Mahatma-esque title of Moses assigned to them as the highest form of affirmation of their roles. You remember Martin Luther King's last speech, April 3rd, 1968. The anniversary is tomorrow. He draws directly from the Exodus narrative. King says, I've been to the mountaintop, and I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I know that we as a people are going to get to the promised land. So I'm not fearing any man. My eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. It is a clear evocation of the Exodus imagery in detail. The challenge is, the question is, can the Exodus motif still sustain this African-American middle-class desire for home? Can it sustain any middle-class desire for home? Can it sustain a Christian desire for home? I think not. Because the Exodus motif, as a parallel in social presence, requires a very clear sense of oppression that simply is not present for those of us who are part of the middle class. The Exodus motif simply does not work, even though it worked in the establishment of this nation, even though it worked in the civil rights movement, even though it worked during slavery. It is difficult to envision where we would be going if we were going somewhere. And so the movement from Exodus to exile becomes increasingly attractive in trying to get at our relationship with the larger culture, both as African Americans in general, and I would argue as Christians in particular, precisely because we're not going anywhere. There has to be some coming to grips with our marginality as blacks on the one hand, or as Christians on the other, and the reality that we have to deal with the structures as they present themselves to us. In the Exodus, there is oppression. In the exile, there is oppression. We're okay there. In the Exodus, the goal is liberation, but as I've mentioned, there's nowhere to go. In the exile, the goal is not liberation, but transformation. It is ministering to Babylon, seeking the peace of the city to which the exile has been called captive, and praying to God on its behalf, for in its shalom, the exile will have shalom. It is the transformation of Babylon and the redirecting of resources that characterizes the exile, not the exodus from Babylon. In the exodus, religious leadership is the focus. Moses is the leader. In the exile, leadership is diffuse among lay people. There's room for the C.S. Lewis's and the Stephen Carters and the lay Christians who are struggling with a sense of vocation. People like John DiIulio trying to work out his soul salvation while being shot at by Christians on the right and the left within the political sphere. The religious leadership is less centered on the priesthood or on the preacher and more so on the extent to which lay Christians like Lewis, like Stringfellow, and other public voices are able to engage the system without being swallowed up by it. The Exodus clearly blames the powers that be. It blames Pharaoh. Pharaoh's at fault. Egypt is bad. Bad. Egypt's bad. In the exile, not only is Babylon evil, But there is also a responsibility for the people of faith to own up to their own accountability for their misery. Indeed, it is part of C.S. Lewis's problem that he's mad that he doesn't get recognized for his scholarly stuff. He wants to be recognized for the scholarly stuff, not just for writing children's stuff. And to a certain extent, all of us crave that same kind of recognition and are accountable for our own misery and our own marginalization. The two come together, of course, in the end. Both the Exodus and the exile are about building homes. The Exodus builds a home over there. The exile is about creating space within the system. It therefore provides a biblical grounding for the African American trying to struggle with contemporary place. And I mention it, I use it, and maybe longer than some people wanted, but I use it as a context because I believe that the Christian community in general, the white evangelical community in particular, can learn from the African American experience of marginality in thinking through its contemporary approach to public engagement. Indeed, for me, the parallels in presence between African-American middle-class spirituality and its struggle with marginality and C.S. Lewis and his struggle with marginality are instructive for us as we think about this new age when government is saying, y'all come and help us with the poor and the oppressed. The black middle class still wrestles with its sense of displacement due to the political conventions of race. But because of its understanding of marginality, it is positioned to engage social and political structures as outsiders, connected to the system as exiles. They are in but not of. They are present but not compromised. They are able to hold on to their two-ness doggedly and clear about ultimate citizenship. Evangelical Christians, take note. For within our own communities, we also ought to live as they have, live as Daniel and Nehemiah. Even when we're employed by the government, we're loyal to Jerusalem. Daniel and Nehemiah were both government employees. We don't think about that too much. Daniel was vice president when he was in the Lion's Den. Nehemiah was probably about a GS-12. Good government job, security, retired 45 and double dip. They see that in the words of Jeremiah. Their role is to be in Babylon, but not of Babylon. Seek the welfare, the peace, the shalom of the city where I have caused you to be carried away exile, and pray to the Lord on its behalf, for in its welfare you shall find welfare. They have strong memory of being an outsider and contemporary reminders, as Coase reminds us in his tome. They understand that Babylon is not home, no matter how much they have integrated the system. No matter how significant their positions and influence in society become, like Esther. Esther, don't think that just because you're the queen that when the deal goes down, they're going to let you off the hook. You're going to die with the rest of the Hebrews. Doesn't matter how well they've been rewarded. Daniel, if you can read the writing on the wall, you get a third of the kingdom and gold around your neck and a scarlet robe. You'll be well rewarded, well compensated. You'll get a full scholarship. You'll get an internship. You'll get into a co-op program. You'll move right to the head of the class, vice president for community affairs. That's usually where black folk go in the corporate world. No matter how well rewarded this middle-class African-American Christian is, there will always be reminders that you're an outsider, that you're on loan, that you do serve the king, and the king's interests are not your interests, but the king's interests, the system's interests. And the system's interests are not the interests of the people of God. Rather, the system seeks to use what the people of God possess for their own interest. And that's what Lewis understood. And that's what I think we need to understand in this new era of cooperation between government and the faith community. Well, what scares me is that we're sort of like Nehemiah. Nehemiah chapter 2, there's one of the funniest confrontations in the Bible. I think it's the second funniest. The funniest one is Samson killing 1,000 people with the jawbone of a mule, right? This isn't in the notes, but this is funny. What was the 1,000th guy thinking of, huh? I mean, come on. This dude has killed 999 people with a bone, and you still want to fight? You know, what does this guy think? You know, I see you kill 999 of my dogs. Come on, man. Circumcise me and call me Abram. You know, I'm on your side. I'm down with the Hebrews, you know. You forget all that Philistine stuff, you know. It's just, that's the funniest thing in the Bible, that this guy had to climb over 999 dead bodies to fight Samson. What an idiot, all right? That's the funniest one. The second funniest one is Nehemiah chapter 2, and it is a metaphor for the current mood of partnerships between the government and the faith community. Nehemiah comes in, he's been praying, he's been weeping over the poor of Jerusalem, over the destruction of the walls, over the fact that the gates are down, the walls are down, the gates are burned with fire. He comes into the king's presence and the king says, Nehemiah, the King James Version, that's the one Jesus used, right? Nehemiah, why is thy face so sad seeing thou art sick, not sick? Now, Nehemiah, if he had been seduced by the system, could have said, boy, the king really cares about me. But Nehemiah is not stupid. He understands that when the king is asking him this question, you know, you're not sick, it has to do with the fact that Nehemiah's job, that good GS-11 job, he's the king's cupbearer, which means he tastes the food before the king does. So when Nehemiah comes in looking sick, the king is not overly concerned about Nehemiah. The king, Nehemiah, what'd you eat, boy? Was it that chicken? Let me know, son. Let me have you examined. The Nehemiah's utility to the king is not based on self-worth, neither is it based on Nehemiah's agenda. It's based on what Nehemiah can do for the king. And those who understand their marginalization over the long haul understand that even when they invite you into the room, it's not because all of a sudden they've seen the light. It's because they see that you've got something that can be beneficial to the larger interests of those in control. Told the church last night, Olivet Baptist Church, said Branch Rickey was no great humanitarian. He was tired of losing to the Yankees and the Giants. That's why he signed Jackie Robinson. He's not stupid. I mean, it took courage to do that, but he wanted to win some ball games. And you see what the Cleveland Indians did a couple months later. They signed Larry Doby and Satchel Paige. And who played in the 1948 World Series? Cough, cough. Folks want to win. And that stuff changes when people have the interest. It's like my grand. I don't know how many of you are ministers in the audience, but I have this problem. Every Thanksgiving, we have the big family gathering. And since I'm the minister in the family, they always ask me to pray. Does your family do that? If you're a minister, they ask you to, you know, well, Dean's going to say the blessing, you know, and I'm sitting there saying, well, you know, why? You know, well, you're the family minister. Hey, you know, Uncle Bob drives a bus. He didn't drive everybody over here, you know. you know, I mean, if we're going to go by vocation, man, next time, you know, we'll all jump in Uncle Bob's car. He can drive us over here. And my grandmother pulls me aside and says, baby, don't you understand what this is? Everybody wants the God in you, but nobody wants the God you got. Everybody wants the results that come as a result of the presence and power of God that resides within you, but they don't want the God who gives the results. It's a utilitarian perspective. What the African-American experience demonstrates over a period of years is you're never fooled when the king sends for you. You know that you're just the canary going in the mine. And that same kind of wisdom and discernment ought to characterize the contemporary Christian church and the other faiths that are currently being engaged by the federal government and by local and state governments, because what is desired is not religion. In fact, we don't even use religion. Now it's a faith-based organization. Somebody please tell, you know, I was vice president of faith-based initiatives, you know, and I never knew, you know, faith-based, crossing the street is a faith-based initiative in the snow, all right? You know, this is religion, but we've got a new euphemism. The challenge for the faith community is to hold on to that marginality, not the kind of marginality that is characteristic of being poor and alienated and isolated from the kinds of social services that make for the good life, but the kind of intentional alienation that a middle-class person engages in when she or he refuses to allow themselves to be co-opted by the system. Nehemiah, Ezra, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, Esther, C.S. Lewis, they operated with a level of engagement that took Babylon seriously, but at the same time never confused Babylon with Jerusalem. They took the political structure seriously. They did not opt out. They worked within the system, but they never confused moving political machinery on behalf of the kingdom to be the kingdom itself. They didn't try to take over Babylon. They tried to influence it. Placed in positions of leadership, Daniel, Esther, and even Nehemiah saw their role within the political order as using their influence on behalf of God's people and plans, though, and this is the warning that Carter offers concerning Christian political engagement, never equating their godly vocation in the political order with the establishment of a theocratic Babylon, a secular political order which can fully reflect the shalom and justice of God. One could argue that influence trumps implementation in this vision. Influence recognizes that whatever is accomplished in the political order can never be taken for granted or mistaken as the actual kingdom. The art of compromise inherent in the political order, an art made messier in a liberal, pluralistic, democratic state, makes it impossible to bring in the kingdom through purely political means. In Carter's book, God's Name in Vain, he talks about the conversation between Fannie Lou Hamer and Hubert Humphrey during the 1964 Democratic National Convention in Atlantic City. He talks about how Hamer had brought the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party to be seated as delegates instead of the all-white Mississippi Democratic Party, which, operating with the laws of segregation, had not permitted blacks to be represented. Humphrey came out with a compromise that would seat both groups. After all, as a politician, he had to make things work for as many people as possible. Fannie Lou Hamer's response jolted the future vice president. It jolted him because he thought he'd come up with a good compromise seating both groups. Hamer says, "That compromise may work for you, Mr. Humphrey, but it won't work for the kingdom. I'm not here for political results. I'm here to represent the kingdom of God." And Hamer knew, I'm sure, that as many down payments on the kingdom as she would see in the political order, she would never see the kingdom fully manifested. In fact, it is at this level of influence, not implementation of the kingdom, that Lewis calls for Christian political engagement. Here is words in the meditation on the third commandment. Christian influence in politics is a good idea. A Christian party is not. Christians will come to different conclusions and join themselves to different parties. A Christian party will not have theological legitimacy. Instead, it will be tempted to accuse those who differ from it with apostasy. This is even more likely when people become overly certain about their political convictions. God has shown us the ends to seek. We must seek the means. It is better to speak to parties what Christians expect from them, rather than to be loyal to any particular party. Converting one's neighbor may be the most Christian political act of all. Lewis's words in Meditations on the Third Commandment come while reflecting on this notion of forming a Christian party in Great Britain during the 1940s. I mentioned that earlier. How different is that than believing that God's agenda is written by either the Democrats or the Republicans in the contemporary political specter? How different is that than the veritable predictability of Christians voting along party lines, not so much according to theology, but according to self-interest? How different than that is African Americans being Democrats and white evangelicals being Republicans? So much so, I mean, my letters to the editor never get published because, you know, they're not nice letters, but the I part of my own vanity is I type my name in Google.com. I don't know if any of you ever do that. I want to see, you know, where are people writing stuff. So I do a Google search on myself every 2 weeks, and I turned up in Christianity Today. Oh wow, I'm in Christianity Today. CT, you know, I mean, you know, this is you know, the popular magazine for the Christian Church, right? So I'm reading, and it's about the meeting that George Bush had with clergy in Austin, Texas, back in December, and there were prominent evangelical leaders there, Reverend so-and-so, Reverend so-and-so, and Dr. Dean Twist. Oh, I'm a prominent leader. You know, that's cool. You know, I like this. And then it goes on and says, to be sure, one can be certain that none of these leaders actually voted for President Bush, but it's a demonstration that he's reaching across party lines. I said, now, I've been a Republican since 1978. And I've voted Republican in most elections. What makes this guy assume I didn't vote for Bush? Well, you know, it's the same reason that I get, and I didn't even have on my blue suit. I mean, what? Lewis worried about those kinds of lines being established, that kind of close partisan alliance between faith communities and the political structure. He worried aloud concerning the extent to which such an effort to legislate the kingdom would create divisiveness in the body of Christ, as well as prove ineffectual in bringing about political ends that were in concert with Christian ends. Lewis goes on, regarding the growing desire for a Christian party, a Christian front, or a Christian platform in politics, nothing is so earnestly to be wished for as a real assault by Christianity on the politics of the world. Nothing at first sight so fitted to deliver this assault as a Christian party. It remains to ask how the resulting situation will differ from that in which Christians find themselves today. It is not reasonable to suppose that such a Christian party will acquire new powers of leavening the infidel organization to which it is attached. Why should it? Whatever it calls itself, it will represent not Christendom, but part of Christendom. The principle which divides it from its brethren and unites it to its political allies will not be theological. It will have no authority to speak for Christianity. It will have no more power than the political skill of its members. Does this sound familiar? Does this sound like the last 20 years of watching us divide evangelical and African-American along Republican and Democratic lines? It will have no authority to speak for Christianity. It will have no more power than the political skill of its members gives it to control the behavior of unbelieving allies. But there will be a real and most disastrous novelty. It will not simply be a part of Christendom, but a part claiming to be the whole. By the mere act of calling itself a Christian party, it implicitly accuses all Christians who do not join it of apostasy and betrayal. If you're not a Republican, you ain't saved. It will be exposed in an aggravated degree to that temptation which the devil spares none of us at any time, the temptation of claiming for our favorite opinions that kind and degree of certainty and authority which really only belongs to our faith, which for Lewis was Christian. Are political, and herein lies the potential for influence. Exile offers influence while relativizing interest. Exile offers the vision of home without the false sense that one is already there. Exile deems the world and its structures unfriendly, thereby reducing the temptation to seduction while still permitting and even mandating terms of engagement. Exile works because people still see themselves as outsiders working on the inside. Be very careful in this new mood of partnerships between the faith community and government, and I say that as one of the people who actually had input into the development of the National Faith-Based Office. I still believe in partnerships, but I believe those partnerships must be undertaken very carefully and out of a sense of integrity on the part of the faith community. The faith community can never feel like it's home. It can never feel like it belongs. And that's why Lewis is instructive for me, because, you know, it's easy to be uncomfortable about being home when you're poor. It's easy to be uncomfortable about your marginality when you're oppressed. It's easy to be uncomfortable about your marginality when your skin color or your gender gives people clear signals that you're marginal. It's much more difficult when the appearance is that you belong. And that's why Lewis's marginality is absolutely critical to understand, because by all appearances, as an Oxford professor, he belongs. The faith community has to live in Babylon, sort of like the gardener in Durham, North Carolina, who at the end of his years of 50 years of gardening in many of the homes in that city, was given a tribute, a ceremonial watch, a parade, and a gift. That gift was consistent with the work that he had done as a gardener, tending lawns, manicuring shrubbery, helping trees grow and add to the beauty of that part of North Carolina. They put him in a balloon and let him fly all over Durham so he could see the results of his handiwork. It was his first time in a balloon, and he was admittedly nervous. He looked around and enjoyed things, but never quite got settled. This big celebration for him still carried a certain amount of trepidation. Even though people were celebrating his presence, he wasn't quite at home. When the balloon landed, they said to him, "Well, how'd you enjoy your time in the balloon?" He said, "Well, I want to thank you for thinking of me, and I enjoyed the ride, and I suppose I'd do it again if I had the opportunity. But I do have to tell you one thing. I never did put all my weight down in that basket." Don't put all your weight down in Babylon. Thank you.
Dr. Trulier is willing and eager to respond to some of your questions and comments. While he is doing that, some folks will be passing among you with some cards for you to fill out so you can share your response with us. We can know who you are and let you know in case you didn't write down the date of next year's talk, when it will be. But we want to thank Dr. Trulier and invite you now to respond as you will.
That's absolutely right. And ethnicity has to do with culture. Everybody has culture. Culture, for my Soc 101 class, culture is the system of shared beliefs, values, and customs common to a group. Okay? Everybody's got that. And so part of, I think, what Marable is getting at in making that distinction between blackness as a racial designation and ethnicity as a cultural designation is that culture has to do with belief and feelings. Politics has to do with where you belong. There's no distinction made between different ethnicities within the black community. For example, here's how we play this game. You know, we look at the intertribal warfare in Africa and say, well, why are the black people fighting each other in Africa? You know, they're fighting each other in Africa. Nobody ever says, how come the white people are fighting each other in Kosovo? Nobody ever says, how come the white people are fighting each other in Ireland? But there's this assumption that because everybody's black, you've got this kind of unanimity in the black community that where they shouldn't fight each other. And the reason for that is that people deal with blackness as a race, that's a political construct, and not the various ethnicities within the black race, which would be Jamaican and Egyptian and Kikuyu and Luo and Dahomey. I mean, there all these different ethnic groups. We understand it when it's white. We don't understand it when it's black because we confuse race and culture. That also relates, I would argue, to the contemporary conversations concerning the African-American community. Oh, who's going to step into the leadership void now that Jesse Jackson has done whatever Jesse Jackson's done? And the answer is, you know, the community's going to be divided. You know, we've got to divide. No. The answer is that there have always been a variety of approaches to racial justice as manifested in the black community. We just didn't tell y'all. You know, and now with increased media exposure, you're seeing. I mean, if you've taken any African American history course, you studied the Booker T. Washington W.B. Du Bois controversy of 1903. If you studied civil rights history, you understood the rift between the NAACP and Thurgood Marshall over whether legislation or litigation was the proper approach to transforming racial justice. There's no monolith. The National Baptist Convention split in 1961 over whether or not to be socially active or not. Martin Luther King was part of the majority that pulled out of the National Baptist Convention. It's nothing new. It's just that the internecine distinctions within the African-American community have now become visible because of increased media attention. It's almost like baseball, you know. If Babe Ruth played baseball today, he'd be a horrible person, wouldn't he? I mean, he's a drunkard, he was a womanizer, all these stuff. I mean, he'd be Daryl Strawberry with a belly. And it's because we have a different level of exposure. So what we're dealing with at this point is not so much a new reality in the black community, but we're dealing with an increased exposure to the diversity within it, and this whole notion of ethnicity is an important part of that, the various ethnic traditions within the black race political tradition. So absolutely, everybody has an ethnicity, everybody has some kind of culture. Yes, sir. I'm optimistic for two reasons, and then pessimistic for one. I'm optimistic because I believe in God, and I believe that God is trying to set up a witness to a different kind of church where we learn something about what it means to be in real reconciliation. Now, Dr. Manny Ortiz at Westminster Seminary has a litmus test for racial reconciliation in the church. He says, if you give me a document on racial reconciliation, I don't see the word justice anywhere, I throw it in the trash. He said, if your understanding of racial reconciliation is just, you know, take a brother to lunch. You know, I mean, I've actually had that. You know, I went to worship at this Presbyterian church, and guy says, hey, you know, I need to take you to lunch because our Promise Keepers group said we should take a black guy to lunch. You want to come to lunch with him? I mean, he just came out and said it. I mean, now, what's neat about that is he said what other people wouldn't say but would do, right? So, I mean, if that's your idea of racial reconciliation that doesn't deal with, you know, the experience that has constantly reflected back to me, right? That's why I saw him. Hey, I don't see you as black. I see you as a person. No. See me as black because that's a part of who I am. That's like me saying to my wife, I don't see you as a woman. I see you as a person. Have and have no kids, okay? No. My wife is a woman. She is female. It's part of her experience. Part of my experience is that when I teach my daggone teenage kids to drive, I got to teach them how not to get knocked in the head by a cop. That's part of what it means to teach a young black male how to drive. He's got to learn where P-R-N-D-L and where both hands go. And when the cop pulls me over, the first thing going through my mind is, oh my gosh, what's going to happen? Let me get under a street light. That's part of who I am. So reconciliation means you enter into a relationship that's part of who I am, and that you understand who I am, and that I understand who you are, that I understand something, for example, about mourning. That one of the things that I think we have to do is we have to let white people mourn, because you're not in charge anymore. I mean, you have this illusion that you're in charge. I mean, God was really in charge, right? But we had this illusion that white people ran the world. And now the statistics are coming in from California. You know, white people are the minority in California. As things shift, see, one of the things that happened was we began to, you know, a lot of people began pointing fingers at white people. You know, you're the bad guy, we're the good guys. You're the oppressor, we're the oppressed. As things changed, as social power changed in some places, a lot of white people lost out. And they need to be able to cry. They need a shoulder to cry on. Because you know what happens? If you've got anger and you don't mourn, then you join the Klan. If you've got anger and you don't mourn, then you start hating. And you misdirect your hate towards the people who are, quote-unquote, taking your place when the decision as to who got to take your place was made up here anyway. So I think that I'm seeing more of an opportunity to understand what the loss of white privilege means in the global context and what it means to allow folks to mourn from that. The third thing is we'd be fools to deny that there's progress. I had one of the most emotional things that has ever happened to me. I won't say the name of the school, but it was a Southern Christian college where I've done lecturing on a number of occasions. And they asked me a couple years ago to come and do a lecture do a lecture series on violence in the faith community. And because that's one of my areas, I've done a lot of work in criminology and faith. And so I came in and presented research on this. And this was one of those Christian colleges where, whoever the distinguished lecturer is has to go to the dorm for a fireside, right? You got to go do a campus crusade, intervarsity milk and cookies. I'm sorry, Terry. An IV milk and cookies thing, you know, with the kids in the dorm, right? And so they said, well, will you do that? I said, well, but the topic is violence. I mean, you want me to go into the dorm and talk about violence? And they said, well, yeah, the speaker's always consistent. I said, well, I'll tell you what. Put your counseling center on alert. Because I'm going to talk about domestic violence. I'm going to talk about date rape. I'm going to talk about incest. I'm going to talk about family violence. So put your counseling center on alert because you're going to get some calls. So if that's what I want to do for a fireside chat. Is that okay? They said, well, we've never had anybody do that before. I said, well, then maybe it's time. So I went to the fireside. You know, we're in the dorm. You know, they're singing, 99 verses of "It Only Takes a Spark to Get a Candle Going" or whatever it is. You know, they got the overhead. You know, 13 guys playing guitar. You know, three chords. You know, the whole thing with the G7th chord underneath the words. You know, and you could tell I used to work for You for Christ, right? So you know, they're doing this stuff, and then I get up and I talk about date rape and violence in the family and guys beating their girlfriends and stuff like that at this Southern Christian college in the middle of nowhere in a dry county. That's about as much as I'll say about it, because if I keep talking, you'll be able to figure out which one it is. And I think when it was over, questions. You got to have questions, right? Questions. Nobody asked questions, right? Not after that. Well, one guy put up and said, I have this friend, and you try to keep a straight face, because, yes, tell me about your friend, it's a serious topic. Well, after the talk was over, this guy, then the line forms. I got this line. And this one young lady came up to me, and she said, you mean it's not my fault my boyfriend beat me? And I said, no. She said, but I used to make him mad all the time. I said, well, remember what we talked about in the talk. Everybody is responsible for their own actions. And he's responsible for how he responds to you. So this is not a matter of, you made him hit you. And she talked about how the people in her church wondered what what did you do to make him so mad? And she said, tonight's the first time I've ever felt like it wasn't my fault. And this little 19-year-old white girl breaks down in tears and grabs me, and I'm holding her for dear life, and she's sobbing. And I'm sitting there saying, 30 years ago, I could have been shot for this. Okay, I was just east of Oklahoma. Am I getting closer? 30 years ago, I'd have been shot in Siloam Springs, Arkansas for hugging a white girl. I don't, things are different. But they're only different when we can get to that level where the conversation can be about the deep and the dark stuff and not just 99 verses of We Shall Overcome in a Martin Luther King service. Or, you know, take a brother to lunch, or, you know, some of my best friends, or I don't see you as. Can we have the conversations about the stuff that really matters? And I see more of a willingness in the white evangelical community to do that now than I did before. I'm pessimistic because people are evil. And the closer we get to the kingdom, the more the enemy turns up the heat. And I think that there'll be more stuff lobbed at us as we really try to get at this stuff, and there'll be more forces that come. I'm not one of these folks that doesn't believe in the devil. I believe there is a devil. You know, I mean, tonight, you know how Arizona could win tonight? I guarantee how Arizona can win tonight if Duke doesn't go on the court. Right? If Duke doesn't go on the court, I'm not saying Arizona couldn't win the other way, but I am absolutely, positively convinced that Arizona would win if Duke didn't show up. Now, of course, that's ridiculous. There's always two teams on the court. That's life. There are two teams on the court. And so I think that my pessimism comes from knowing that as creatures of the West, we underestimate the spiritual wickedness that will try to attack any efforts towards reconciliation, because we think that it's merely a matter of social engineering and not of spiritual warfare. Long answer. Sir. See, this is what I think. I think I'm very heavily influenced by William Stringfellow on this. His book, An Ethic for Christians and Other Aliens in a Strange Land. I mean, Stringfellow was another one of these exile people. And Stringfellow's argument would be that you don't ask that question so much as you engage wherever you can, knowing that you'll never be ultimately successful until the second coming. His model was the resistance. His model was the resistance during World War II. He said the fighters in the resistance did three things. You know, and, you know, for some of us, we've read the history. The rest of us, we all saw Hogan's Heroes. That's as close as we got to the resistance, right? But at least you've got a framework. Thank God for the show. You've got a framework, right? You know, the underground. He said the underground did three things. He said, number one, the underground read Scripture, because what Scripture did was that it defined a reality other than the one in which they lived. It let them know that though the Axis power seemed to control the way in which life was going, there was clearly another reality, and the Bible defined it. And they needed to know that, to use Lewis's sense, that that wasn't home. The second thing they did was they participated in acts of resistance. You know, you blow up a bridge, you blow up, you know, now I'm thinking Hogan's Heroes, you blow up a ball bearing plant. They always blew up the same ball bearing plant, right? You know, you know that any one of these events will not topple Hitler. But the two things you know, number one, it'll make a dent, and number two, it'll give you dignity. Because you are not cooperating with the evil. You're making a stand. It's not symbolic, because it accomplishes something, but it doesn't overturn the whole thing. He said the third thing they did was they waited for D-Day. They knew that ultimately deliverance would come not through their small acts of sabotage and non-cooperation that was more to preserve dignity and make a dent, but that ultimately deliverance would come when an alien force would land and pull them out. And that's the second coming for me. But you don't, in anticipation of the second coming, stop blowing up bridges.
and acts of non-cooperation. You've got to find where those spaces are, and you do them within the context of the system. I mean, it was very, very. I admire lay people more than anything. I was one of these guys that went straight through seminary after college. I never had a lay job until three and a half years ago when I went to PPV as a researcher. Until that time, all I did was I ran campus life clubs, pastored churches, and taught in seminary. And I'm going to go back to my old church and apologize to every lay person, because I didn't know how hard it was to live like a Christian when it wasn't your job description. And the compromises that you're asked to make working in the secular world, the difficulty it is in trying to be a godly presence, trying to mobilize resources, try to get the king to do something. That was part of my job. My job was to write reports for the government and write reports for philanthropy and to get them to give money to churches. That was my job for 3 years. And, you know, I had to learn how to change language. And well, they do evangelism. No, you can't talk about evangelism in government. Okay, well, they do outreach. Yeah, that's a better word. Okay, conversion. No. We don't do conversion here. It's like an old Get Smart movie. This is chaos. We don't convert here, right? And so conversion became values, clarification, and transformation. I mean, these are all in my reports. You can look on the PPV website. You'll see all these phrases. There is no more discipleship. There's mentoring. Right? And so you got to check. My editor sends me back, what do you mean authentic witness of the church, of the congregation? So I'm just talking about having an integrity that, you know, what they say is what they do. She says, then say have an integrity what they say. I spent 3 years being bilingual, and I got tired of it. And I said, I want to go back and preach. And the company was quite ready for me to go back and preach because my faith was showing. But somebody's got to stand in that place. Somebody has got to, and that's why I admire Lewis, because I just spent 3.5 years trying to be what he spent his whole life being, which was a layman trying to live out a faith commitment in a very public way. And I look at my colleague and my friend John DiIulio, and sometimes things he says make me cringe, but I also know that I wouldn't trade. You could not give me gold around my neck, a scarlet robe, and 1/3 of the kingdom for his job. He's getting shot at by the left and the right. They used to say if you walk down the middle of the street, you get hit by both sides of traffic, and the struggle that you all have in so-called secular jobs to manifest a godly presence and to raise the godly issues, the kinds of stuff that Stephen Carter's doing up at Yale. I mean, it's fascinating to me that I mentioned to you that Carter's doing the Yale Devane lecture. He's doing the lecture on religion and democracy. Isn't it interesting that as a constitutional law professor and not a seminary professor, Yale does have a seminary, but they're getting a law professor to do the talk on religion. I admire people who take that on. What I argue is, and I think this is behind your how long will it take question, is no matter how much of that good stuff you do, it ain't going to bring in the kingdom. That's D-Day. We're just the underground. Ma'am. Good question, and I'm not going to answer it. And I'll tell you why. But in not answering it, I'll tell you why I won't answer, and I'll tell you how I think you get at that. See, I was asked to define justice last week at the SCOOP conference, the Seminary Consortium on Urban Pastoral Education. And I gave a definition of justice to this group of African-American and Latino pastors as part of a focus group I was running. And I had three people put their hands up and say, I don't agree with your definition of justice, because I used the term fairness in my definition. I was basically speaking about distributive justice. And they said, sometimes justice is not fair. And so we disagree with your understanding of justice. So we ended up with this long conversation, which I think they wanted, half of them wanted, so they didn't have to do the focus group work. But we did this long conversation. And part of what emerged from it was that there was no clear consensus among these 35 folk of what justice was, and that we need to talk more about it. So that, I mean, if I answer your question and tell you what I think justice is, then, you know, here's a couple million black people that don't agree with my definition, and they're not in the conversation. So that what I call for is a much larger conversation that reflects the diversity of understandings of justice amongst the white and black communities, plural, that gets us beyond three things. Number one, that gets us beyond racial justice as the benchmark of what justice is. Okay, in other words, when we talk about justice in the black community, are we just talking about racial justice? Are we talking about justice for all? That's a fair question. Number two, that gets us beyond the notion that black people don't have a right to think about or to talk about justice in the other areas. You know, sort of like, you know, what's Jesse Jackson doing in Syria? What's Sandy Young doing in South Africa? You know, you guys should stick to America. That's what you guys know. In fact, I think it was Miles Monroe who talked about the need for African Americans to become much more global. He says, and I can say this to you because I'm from the Bahamas. He says, you African Americans, you're like most Americans. You know, Americans are so ethnocentric, you play the World Series all by yourself. So what right do we have as African Americans to talk about justice in other contexts? And then the third thing is whether or not we're willing to consider restoration. The one thing that I would argue, whether or not we're willing to consider some levels of restoration, what does that look like? Now, I mean, we just had this major thing where David Horowitz, you know, attacked reparations. I'm not necessarily calling for reparations, but is there a restorative justice component to a variety of marginalized populations, and what does that look like? And how do we do that in such a way that we're not pitting, watch this, that we're not pitting blacks who've been discriminated against poor whites who've been discriminated against? Because, see, that's the way the game is played. See, what you do is you get the black people and the poor white people to fight each other. See, there's no affirmative action for Fortune 500 executives. You know, the affirmative action jobs are always over the contested areas that somebody else up here has control over. And my problem with affirmative action is not so much that, you know, it's unfair, it's unjust, or that, but my problem with affirmative action is that it pits people in competition over scarce resources who are still marginalized to power. And are we willing to listen to each other long enough that you can hear my anger, not just the anger of the poor, but the anger Alex Coase talks about, which is the rage of the black middle class. That's what this book is about. And then am I willing to sit there long enough and listen to you talk about what you've lost as a result of the changes and then figure out where to go from there? I've seen very few conversations that have been willing to hear each other's sense of loss without getting defensive. And I think that's the starting point for the conversation.